From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. They say technology changes everything. Right now, it's changing school from kindergarten to high school for students right across this country. About 250,000 students are now enrolled in full-time online K through 12 schools. Up to 2 million students take some classes online. Online schools are run by states, by school districts, by private companies, by universities. Their students range from those who are eager to go beyond their physical school's curriculum to those falling behind their classmates. This hour on Point, what it means when students leave the physical classroom for a virtual one, when school goes online. You can join the conversation. Is this you, an online student in high school, let's say, from home? Is this a great leap forward? Is it a good education? Is it a crutch when physical schools don't make the grade? How's it working? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me first today is Bill Tucker, Managing Director of Education Sector, an education think tank in Washington. He specializes in technology and education. In 2000, he co-founded Smarter.org, Inc., an e-learning company that he sold in 2002. He's been tracking online schooling across the country. Bill Tucker, thank you very much for being with us today. Hello, Bill, are you there? We'll get Bill in just a moment. Also with us today from Stanford, California, is Clifford Nass, Professor of Communication and Education at Stanford University, where he directs the Communication Between Humans and Interactive Media Lab. He's author of The Man Who Lied to His Laptop, What Machines Teach Us About Human Relationships. Clifford Nass, welcome. Thank you very much for being here.
Delighted to be here.
We've got people from right across the spectrum of attitudes about online education in this hour. We're going to hear from Florida, where they have a very big state push on, but it's hardly the only push going on right now. We're going to hear from some of your colleagues at your university, Stanford, which is pushing out a very kind of high-end, advanced online high school program. But I know, Clifford, that you have some misgivings about this big new trend. What are you thinking about it?
Well, the concern is that the purpose of public education is to build citizens broadly defined, and that includes more than just reading, writing, and arithmetic. It includes the ability to work with others, the ability to develop healthy social and emotional life, and the research suggests that online, unfortunately, doesn't do that as well as we would like.
What do you think is driving the move to online education? It's still a tiny fraction of the overall. But it's growing like topsy. You look at the charts here, they're just going up and up and up. What's driving that?
Well, I think there's two separate trends. For the broad base, it's really cost. States and others are trying to save money, and in many ways, online education, especially lower-end online education, tends to be much cheaper. I think in certain cases for highly, highly specialized materials, for people who just can't get the information any other way, there's also tremendous demand. So I think both of those are going on.
Bill Tucker in Washington, it's good to have you with us. Give us a sense of the scale and expansion of online education. How big and how fast do you see it growing, Bill?
Hi, thanks for having me, Tom. We're definitely seeing a very rapid expansion. At the top of the show, you talked about the numbers, but it's not just the numbers of students. It's the numbers of schools or numbers of school districts or states that are offering online learning, all continuing to grow and grow in the many different ways that you described at the top. I think that many times we think of the full-time online student and have horrible visions of a student kind of connected to their computer in a matrix-like way. But that's not the total case. Many of the fastest growing areas are what's called blended learning, where schools are thinking about how to integrate digital and traditional classroom-based. And that's probably the place where we're going to see things grow the most.
So when we say 250,000 students full-time online in K-12, I assume most of those are in high school. But those, that 250,000, not the 2 million who are supplementing or taking an occasional course online, those 250,000 American students, you say it's not like the Matrix where they're just sitting in a cubicle plugged into their computer, but the computer will be their primary interface and presumably not in a school, but most likely at home with their education, Bill.
That's true. In many of the cases, those programs rely heavily on what they call a learning coach or a learning partner. That ends up being the parent many times.
So the parent sort of rides along with them. You had a little Freudian slip there and said heavenly. Are a lot of these just traditional homeschoolers? Are a lot of these many homeschoolers, not all by any means, but many tend to be religious and homeschooling in part because of that? Is that what's driving this number? Is this homeschooling, religious homeschooling, as opposed to just people looking for an alternative to the public school, Bill?
I think Clifford mentioned that they're a mix of motivations. And so from the student standpoint, there are homeschoolers who see this as, wow, I can have my student at home. I may not want him or her in a traditional class environment. And I get to take advantage of teachers on the other end of the computer and curriculum and all sorts of things. So there are those. There are all sorts of other reasons, too. You have students who, for health reasons or for they're aspiring actors, they don't feel safe in their school, they don't feel like their current school is performing. So it's a real mix. There are definitely a number of what were formerly homeschoolers. And it's important to note that in the public programs, this is public education.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't mean anything goes. And it does mean that there needs to be accountability for those funds. It's public education, even if it does take place at home.
Public education, though, a lot of them, when they do this, and we'll talk about this, but a lot of them draw on private commercial offerings of that education. We'll look at that. Bill, just give us a sense. Let's say I'm one of these 250,000 students, probably a high school student, but maybe younger, who's doing my learning online at home. What is that experience like? When the computer turns on in the morning, if that's when I start, what's the interaction? What does a class look like? What does assignment look like? What do tests look like? How does it work, Bill? Paint the picture for us.
Sure. The biggest change is that it's doesn't necessarily all take place within the defined 8-to-3 time period. Mm-hmm. Students schedule their own pace. Generally, they go at their own speed, and they might be in a mixture of levels. So a student who's really great in math might be in an advanced math course. Someone who is behind in science or reading might be doing things at a little bit of a lower grade level. The students tend to work when they're most productive. So you'll see students who are logging on at night. You'll see students who are doing things during the day. They might get science kits shipped to them and be doing things in their kitchen around experiments. All of the interactions don't take place online. So they still read books. They still do field trips. They still go do other things. So it's much more of a personalized and individualized education. You will see, and depending on the program, there could be video conferences with teachers and other students. They could be Skyping. There should be a lot of interaction between students and other students and students and teachers. That's not always the case. It depends on the quality of the program. So it's definitely a very different cadence, pace, and very personalized.
So Clifford Nass, here I've got my computer, and I've got, you know, video chat, and I've got classmates, even if they're not all studying at the same time. I've got lectures, I've got assignments and reading and tests, and I get my feedback. You point to the social aspect as one that's missing here, but in purely educational terms, what does the record show about the effectiveness of this kind of learning, Clifford? Education is a holistic thing, so we won't leave it out permanently. But if you want to look at it just as scholastic, you know, a gathering of learning, does it work?
Well, it's a complicated question in that in any type of educational environment, be it one-to-one tutoring, be it a large classroom, be it online, etc., the key determinant is quality of program, much as if you said, are movies fun to watch? It really depends on the movie. There are certainly examples of, for a certain category of students, certain categories of subjects, certain learning outcomes where online can be extremely effective. There are also, of course, cases where it's much less effective. One of the issues is this idea that students do things when they're most effective. I don't think that there's very strong evidence of that. If we look at students historically, students tend to put off things. That's a pretty typical thing in that age group. Again, one of the reasons we gather students together in a given place is precisely because of the idea of monitoring. So to what extent are kids doing this at night because they'd rather be doing other things during the day or, you know, focusing on the activities they really enjoy when they're, quote, most alert, most active, and then slipping in schoolwork. I think the assumption, which we would, of course, love to be true, that education is the first thing on the minds of high school students would be a great one. I'd be real happy about that, but I don't know that the evidence shows that. Are there certainly motivated kids? Of course there are. And so it's just as with programs, we can say that there's a particular learning style that's effective for all kids.
Bill Tucker, I'm looking here at critics citing significant studies showing less positive performance by online educated kids than classroom educated kids. What do you say to that?
Well, I think Clifford has it exactly right. We see tremendous variability across program types. And so the quality of the program, the quality of the curriculum, the quality of the teaching. Many times we think about this just as computers, but there are teachers. And to the extent that Clifford's also exactly right about motivation, there's a real role there to ensure that students are focused on the learning and staying in touch and engaged.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking this hour at the rise of online high school and more K-12 education online as more and more young Americans get their education on the Internet. 250,000 American students, K-12, now doing that full-time. Another couple million taking some courses online. We've been joined this hour by Bill Tucker, Managing Director at the education think tank Education Sector in Washington. And from Stanford University, Clifford Nass is with us. Lots of callers here. Ron on I-95 near Fernandina Beach, Florida. Ron, thanks for calling. You're on the air. What do you know?
Hi, Tom. Hi. I'm the parent of one of those 250,000 online students, and for our case, it worked exceptionally well. Our daughter has moved on to university. Her freshman year has a 4.1 GPA.
Congratulations.
And it was for all the reasons I think Clifford mentioned. It was safety. It was the competition in the school setting for all kinds of things besides academics, whether it was appearance or apparel. It was the ability to be an active participant in our child's education, to explore subject matters broader than simply the test that was on the schedule for the following week.
That's really interesting. Ron, let me ask you a couple of things. First of all, did your daughter go stir crazy sitting at home with the computer screen and assignment after assignment? Did she go, you know, nuts feeling hemmed in there, or did she like it?
No, she loved it, and she was not strictly virtually schooled. The Florida virtual school was only one aspect. The state of Florida has a program that allows for dual enrollment. So she, in her junior year, began attending classes at a community college to supplement the online experience, where she had great success as well.
That sounds pretty good. And how about the experience of it? Did she have you or her mother, perhaps, as a learning coach alongside her at home, or was it just 8 hours a day while you were both off at work and her doing it herself?
No, she had her mother as a full-time learning coach. She was particularly self-motivated. We have a 14-year-old as well, and he simply isn't the same kind of candidate for this program. But Florida's laws allowed her to participate in extracurricular activities, so she had access to social outlets, and it was truly a fantastic experience for the entire family.
And your daughter's off to college and got a 4.1 grade point average going there. That sounds pretty good in your case, Ron. I really appreciate your call of that firsthand experience. We're going to hear from Florida in just one second. Let me get one more call first from Steubenville, Ohio. Sue is calling. Hi, Sue. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
Tom?
Hi. What do you know, Sue?
I am. I have a background in education and educational research. also just recently stopped teaching, doing the substitute teaching. And, you know, I listened to the previous caller, and if there are those kind of social outlets for kids, and all for it. But I've seen kids who were homeschooled who hit college who did not have the social aspect of school, the regular school. And when they hit college, they were really a C. So I think that we've got to improve public schools, and when the parents take their kids out of that environment, they're also not participating in making the school better for the whole community.
So there is a kind of checking out of the common endeavor going on there, and you're afraid they may be at sea, as you say, Sue, when they get to college. It wasn't Ron's experience, but it could be for others. I appreciate your call as well. Let's look at the Florida experience. They're a very big state when it comes to online education. Joining us right now from Orlando, Florida, is Pam Bertolo. She's Chief Educational Services Officer at the Florida Virtual School, oversees the school's instruction. It's the largest online school in the country, Florida's, served more than 122,000 students in the 2010-2011 year, 1,500 of whom were full-time. This year, the number of full-time students in the Florida system jumped to 4,300. Pam Bertolo, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
Why has Florida put such a big effort into taking education online, Pam?
At Florida Virtual School, we are a public school in Florida, so it is definitely a public school initiative. And we were designed not to be a binary choice, but to be a choice. So it's not an either-or. The majority of our students are actually enrolled in a public school and pick up one or two courses with us. So first and foremost, it was to offer another choice for students and families to help them determine individualized learning plans.
Determine individualized learning plans. What does that mean? Does it tend to mean if I'm in a high school, I want to take Latin, they don't offer it, I can take it online, or Chinese or Russian or AP Calculus? Is that the kind of thing that is typically supplemented?
Right. So there are as many different reasons to take an online course as there are kids. So often, perhaps a child in a rural district can't pick up a course because it's not offered there. So that is a service. We partner with the districts. That's a service to the districts. Or perhaps a child is traveling a great deal. Perhaps a child has a scheduling conflict at their school. Marine biology and marching band are offered the same period. So they pick up marine biology, not marching band yet, okay, with us, and they can participate in marching band. So there are just many, many, many reasons, everything from acceleration, because in Florida students can accelerate, to remediation, to everything in between.
Now, when it comes to remediation, there's been some criticism that, you know, students don't pass a class, they're assigned to take it again, maybe online. There they do pass. Some of the reporting that's come out recently, Pam, has portrayed that remedial online instruction as a kind of easy way to get through the class. You know, click, click, test, done is the kind of the send-up of it. Is that really working, or is it just a way to get your numbers up for students, you know, moving ahead? When is it as rigorous as the in-classroom experience, Pam?
So, Tom, I think that's a very good question, and I think as online learning becomes more and more mainstream, there's going to be a real push to assess quality and make sure that students and parents and districts know what they're getting. So there's a lot of answers to your question. At Florida Virtual School, our courses are considered extremely rigorous, and we don't have special remediation courses. So a student can come back to us. They get the same course that a student would get any other time. The reason that students might choose to come to us is we're 365 days a year, so they can enroll with us any time.
That's handy. They can do it anytime if they've got the discipline to take care of that. Your former governor, Jeb Bush, was a big proponent of online education. Is there an ideological component to this, Pam? Of course, it's public, but you've got, I assume, contributions from private education providers within it. Is that part of what's going on here? Is this like the charter school movement, an effort to get it into at least a hybrid of private and public?
So that's a good question. I think that we're seeing the hybrids in some states. I think we're seeing public school districts and state pushes other places. As Bill said earlier, I think we have a model that is growing up and becoming more and more of a blended model. I think we're going to see all kinds of what I call mezclas. In other words, mixes of looking at what really works for each individual child. What kind of learning is going to work for them in certain situations. I think where I get concerned, Tom, is when we talk about online learning like it's either classroom or online. I think we have to look at there's a place for all of this, right? And we need to find a way for it to work together to best keep the student at the center of every decision we make.
Is it in these hard-pressed financial times, is it going to save Florida money long-term? Is it saving Florida money already? You don't have to build that many more classrooms or offer that many more classes physically?
Right. I think what we're going to find in the end, although our FTE is the lowest FTE in the state of Florida.
What does that mean,
FTE? In other words, in the state of Florida, the per pupil funding, every district, there's 67 districts plus several of what are considered special school districts. We're one of them.
Okay.
Every school district has a funding formula, and we have one of the lowest funding formulas. I don't know. It's going to be interesting to watch and see what all the different research shows about online learning and being big savings. I think that online learning, just like classroom learning, is about great teachers, and I'm not convinced we're going to see huge savings if we serve up online learning correctly.
Bill Tucker, Clifford Ness, I want to bring that cost question to you, but let's get a listener here first. Dean in Providence, Rhode Island. Dean, thanks for calling. You're on the air, Dean.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Well, thanks.
Good. I think on the subject of online learning for high school students, that really it's for that top 10% of students that are capable intellectually and developmentally to take, you know, either all online or a mixed mode, meaning some online, some in-class experience. I've worked in higher education for 13 years, and developmentally, the difference between an 18-year-old and a 17 or 16-year-old isn't that great. And we've seen in higher education that online learning is definitely something for that student that is self-motivated, is independent, is already a great, strong student, and does well, and doesn't need peers and a teacher and a regular socialized classroom.
Dean, let us look at this issue of who it's ideal for. And Bill Tucker, let me bring that to you first. Now, Dean says he thinks it's great for the top 10% who are good learners, self-motivated, and all the rest. That may be true. On the other hand, from my reading here, it looks like it's being used a lot for students who need remedial help as well. What about that question, Bill?
So the earlier discussion with Pam really hit on a critical topic. And again, this gets to program quality. We find online learning to be really effective for students at both ends of the bell curve, or if you think about a barbell, the high-achieving students and students who are not doing well in the traditional class environment. You can't just throw those students in and say, hey, guess what? You're with a computer. Good luck. That's not going to work. But what you do find is that when you're able to individualize the learning, take them out of a place where they failed a number of times and provide the right supports and motivation. Pam talks about great teaching, and this is a key of it, a key element. It can be very successful, those students. Not always, and you can't just throw them in there, but in many times it's the students who aren't succeeding in the traditional classroom who a different method can work for.
What, do you have a sense nationally of whether the bulk of online students are students getting remedial help there, students having difficulty in the regular school, or you know, top learners?
I think it's a real mix. You see in many of the programs they start out that are the statewide programs. They start out around the access issue. I want to be able to access the advanced placement class, or I want to be able to access the foreign language that isn't available in my school in rural West Virginia. You see at the district level, many of the districts are replacing summer school and they're going online. And so You see many times the what are called credit recovery programs. And you mentioned some of the problems there if those are just watered down courses for students who already are not succeeding. If they get an even lower watered down, that's a real problem. And that's a place where we really do need to ensure that the quality is there.
We've got all kinds of response online. John says, I hated high school. I would much rather have learned on my own. And he says, it would be good training for life, as I now spend 8 hours a day in a cube sitting at a computer. Ad says, school is where children learn to interact with one another and with authority figures. They learn how to resolve problems they can't avoid by staying in their rooms at home. It's a difficult but important part of childhood development. Taking it away is just not smart. On Twitter, Jonathan says, online ed is a tremendous tool to supplement in class, but do both in conjunction, he says. And then this, Peter on Facebook writes, using the web to provide or augment learning should be a major effort in educational reform. That takes great teachers, whether in real or virtual classrooms. The problem, Peter writes, is that when the free market enters, and it does a lot in online education, whether in charter or virtual schools, profits are sadly driven by numbers of students, and success is measured by credits and diplomas, not by learning. Just look at for-profit colleges. Clifford Nass, what about that? If you've got a lot of private companies involved in online learning, is there a temptation to just sort of, you know, churn out the diplomas? We've seen that in some for-profit higher ed, and the real learning takes a back seat, Clifford.
Well, there's always been a profit motive. I mean, textbook publishers are virtually all profit-making organizations, the people who build the science kits people mentioned earlier. I mean, there's always been, obviously, a large profit sector engaged in public education. So I think, as such, that's not necessarily a problem. Would we want to say we don't want to have any textbooks because, after all, they're all produced by profits? Or even books in libraries. You know, books, the vast majority of books are printed by profit-making entities. We want to say we better ban all books that aren't published by nonprofits. I don't think that the profit-making motive per se is an issue. And on the other hand, we've always, of course, had supplemental things called books. I've never seen anyone slap a book out of someone's hand saying, oh my God, you're learning outside of class. Let's just cut that out right now for some purpose. So the notion that supplemental things are a priori good, that's always been true. As far as the helping kids who are not succeeding, anyone who's tried to teach anyone anything, if method A doesn't work, you try method B. And if method B doesn't work, you try method C. It's not surprising that kids who don't do well in a classroom environment will do well at something else or something else or something else again. The one concern with all this is any money spent on online is taking away from something else. It's not somehow there's these new resources, new funds. So the real question is, where's the biggest bang for the buck? Is the biggest bang for the buck supporting supplemental learning as a public education, or is it improving existing schools that impact a large number of students? So Pam, I think there's a false dichotomy here.
Pam, I've just got you for another second. We've got 122,000 students using this now. What's your goal? What percentage of Florida students do you ultimately hope will do some online learning?
That's a great question. We don't really think about it that way. We think about meeting the needs of the students who come to the door, and our numbers continue to grow, but that's not really what we're proud of. What we're proud of is how our students, their learning outcomes.
Mm. Pam Bertolo, Chief Educational Services Officer with Florida Virtual School. Pam, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're looking this hour at the rise of online high school and more online K-12 education as more and more young Americans get their education on the Internet. We've been listening and learning from right across the country today. Bill Tucker has joined us from Washington, Managing Director at the education think tank Education Sector there. Clifford Nass is with us from Stanford University. He directs the Communication Between Humans and Interactive Media Lab. We're going to hear from another big effort in just a moment, but a couple of calls first. Lauren in Richmond, Kentucky. Lauren, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
What do you think?
I had a few perspectives for this.
Okay.
I went to a rural Kentucky high school, and we only offered one foreign language, which was Spanish, and we actually offered French for 2 years, and I was lucky enough to get that.
Uh-huh.
During those 2 years when they got funding for it.
Yes.
Everything else, I mean, we only had like four AP classes. It was not good. And I would have killed to have been able to have gone online and gotten things that I couldn't get in my school.
So it sounds good to you in that way. If your local school was limited in its offerings, you would like to have been able to go on and get something more.
Yeah, and it was at least 45 minutes away for me to commute to another school. So it wasn't an option.
Are you confident that you would have had a good quality education with that online offering?
I am, because I'm sure it would have come from either Western Kentucky University or the Owensboro Community College, and I did take some hybrid courses during high school from Owensboro Community College, and they were all high quality, so I'm sure that it would have been as good, at least, as I could have gotten in my high school had it been in classroom.
So there's a voice from Kentucky saying, yes, please, I would love to have had the options that online education might bring. Lauren, I appreciate your call. Let's get one more here. Scott, Clayton, New York. Scott, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Hey, just wanted to give a little bit of perspective to this. As a junior high student and a high school student back in the late 70s and early 80s, I lived up in Alaska during the pipeline. And I know that this whole internet commuting, internet classes is something new. But I know for a fact back in the 70s and the 80s, a lot of the schooling for the kids who lived out in the bush was done over CB radios, over base stations. They would sit at the table with their textbook out, and they would follow along with their teachers. Their teacher broadcast from a central location.
Yeah.
It seemed to work quite well, and as far as I know, there are still some locations up in the bush that are still doing this.
So there's real precedent here, even before the internet, using it by CB radio out to a cabin on the Yukon or wherever you might be in Alaska. Scott, I appreciate your reminding us of that. I want to bring another voice in here right now. Jeffrey Scarborough joins us. He's in Boulder, Colorado today, but when he's at his workplace, he's headmaster of the education program for gifted youth online high school at Stanford University. It offers education grades 7 to 12. School has 121 full-time, 97 part-time, 182 single-course students. This is a kind of elite online offering for advanced students at that end of the scale. Jeffrey Scarborough, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Tell us, why is a top school like Stanford University getting into online education for middle school and high schoolers, Jeffrey?
Well, I think there's a unique need and a unique opportunity that's presented by the online environment. As much as the online environment generates a lot of interest and presents some opportunities for bringing together talented students with talented instructors, our focus is really on looking at how to provide a challenging, rigorous education for students who are talented and passionate about learning. So it's in many ways consistent with the mission of the university.
So in your case, you're not just putting this out there and anybody can jump on board. There, as I understand it anyway, is kind of a rigorous application process for the privilege of taking this online education, Jeffrey.
Right. Certainly, it's a rigorous program that requires a lot of talent and dedication on the part of the students. And so we certainly want to be sure in the admission process that students are positioned to succeed at the school. And so that's what we're looking for in the application.
So are you looking for students who may have outrun their own high school's offerings? They're looking to sort of take it right on up higher. They're ahead of what they could do in their normal school. So they've got the option of coming online and working with you?
We do have a lot of students who are advanced in a particular subject, who are advanced in many subjects, and who come to us at a certain stage in their high school career, looking for something, a challenging course at the AP level, at the post-AP level. We have courses that are comparable in content to university courses in a variety of disciplines. So that's certainly one group of students who are interested in our school. But at the same time, we have a comprehensive curriculum from 7th grade to 12th grade. that has a focus on critical reasoning and a deep mastery of the content. So students as early as seventh grade can come to the school, pursue advanced opportunities in a discipline, but be challenged in across the board.
Now, this Stanford Online High School does not come cheap. I mean, this is an online education, but you have an annual tuition of $14,800. That seems pretty steep. Why such a high cost for online education? People tend to think of it as more economical to do, as cheaper to provide.
Certainly, we don't have the cost and facilities that certain schools have, but we really look at this as a world-class education that's comparable in content to a lot of elite schools that ultimately cost a lot more. And I think, drawing on what some of your callers and other guests have mentioned, ultimately, this is a lot about teaching. And teaching, we really focus on expertise of our instructors. A lot of our instructors come from an academic background, from elite schools, and they really know how to challenge talented students within their discipline, how to model in our live discussion sections advanced inquiry in a discipline. And that's not something that that really is so cost effective.
Clifford Nass out in California. Now, here's a big, high profile effort that's been launched by your own institution, Clifford, the Stanford Online High School. I know you've got some misgivings about online learning, but here's one coming out of your own backyard. Do you have those same misgivings when it's aimed at top tier students, Clifford, when it comes to social emotional development, the development of citizens?
Yes and no. The EPGY program, the program at Stanford, is extremely well done. A lot of the funding goes towards research and quality. They have a great deal of teacher involvement, etc. So to that extent, I have no concerns whatsoever that the kids doing it are getting an absolutely superb education of an academic of a very particular sort, namely learning, you know, math, critical reasoning, etc. I do have those concerns, again, for the full-time students. The research shows that, you know, in social-emotional development, face-to-face communication is important. Motivation, sustaining motivation is important. Learning to work in teams and projects, which is becoming an increasingly important part of 21st century workplaces of all kinds. Those are things that these programs don't provide as well, and often, and in most cases, don't provide at all. So while programs like the one at Stanford do an absolutely superb job, I've looked at their mathematics curriculum, it's absolutely superb, but that's not the sole purpose of a high school or public education.
Jeffrey, I want to come to you with that, but let me get a call, if I may, from Becky in Hamden, Connecticut. Becky, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm calling because immediately when your show started, I was reminded of a New York Times article that I think you probably saw about the chief executive officers and other executives from Silicon Valley, executives from Google and Apple and eBay, who are all sending their children to a completely low-tech Waldorf school.
Yeah.
One executive from Google said the idea that an app on an iPad can teach my kids better to read or do arithmetic is ridiculous. And their concerns are critical thinking, human interaction, creativity, problem-solving skills. Those are from the Waldorf School, their mission, I guess you'd say. I'm in higher education.
Yes.
And I've done some study of early childhood education and middle school education. And my main concern is that the younger the child, the more important the relationship with parents, with teachers. I mean, that human interaction is so critical. That's what children learn. You know, that's how they learn to be citizens, as you said. And so, I mean, yes, high tech, it's certainly part of our life, and children need to learn that. But I think balance and keeping in mind the relationship with teachers, with parents, that mentoring is so critical. And I'll take your comments off the air.
Thank you, Becky. I'm so glad for that call. Jeffrey Scarborough, how about that? I did see that article of Silicon Valley executives, these are people who know technology inside and out, very deliberately taking their kids out of the technology environment when it came to their fundamental education. That would seem to stand as kind of a rebuke to what you're up to, Jeffrey Scarborough. What did you make of that?
Well, I think the focus on personal interaction is exactly right and extremely important. And that's really a centerpiece of our program. We do keep a lot of the lecture-type content in an asynchronous format, but the real focus of our instruction and of our school is in live discussion sections that are much like a virtual Harkness table for people who are immersed in the private school world, where there's a really active interaction among individual students and with instructors.
But even for these young people who may have been weaned on Facebook since they were 6 years old, for all I know, is a live discussion, really live chat online, the same as, you know, that conversation in a room where, you know, the sort of old Dead Poets Society ideal of, you know, people hashing it out and hands chopping the air, and you can see the sweat on your professor's brow as he tries with passion to get the point across. Can it be as good as that, Jeffrey?
Well, I think there's a lot of potential in the medium. So we have a video conferencing environment and, you know, all sorts of virtual equivalents. But I think it's important to note that the classroom is capable of generating the sort of passion that flows outside of the classroom and is really the basis for the life of our school community. So I think one of the things I'm driven most frequently to write about is the remarkable community that our students have established through myriad interactions outside of the classroom, whether it's a Skype study group for a final exam or meetups in various parts of the country. The community grows from the interaction that the students have in the classroom, and I think that that's a testament to the capacity of a rich video conferencing environment with proper instruction and material to generate the sort of excitement that talented and passionate students are looking for.
Clifford Nass, what do you make of the reporting on high-tech executives in Silicon Valley in your backyard there at Stanford taking their kids deliberately to a low-tech setting for education? Should that give the rest of us pause when we look at online instruction?
Well, I think that it really reflects the idea that these executives, many of whom I consult with and work with, recognize these kids are going to be able to find technology. They're going to be able to find the supplemental material. They're going to be able to find all these things. So the question is, what is not being provided? What they're trying to do, as every parent does, is figure out what their kid is not getting and doing that. And that's exactly why they're sending the kids to these schools. The issue is really one of, what do you lose and where do you find it? And that's exactly what's coming out of these executives.
Maybe they've got the technology already. Chelaney in Nashville. Thanks for calling, Chelaney. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you.
Yeah.
I am an education student, and I'm very intrigued by this conversation. I think that that virtual classrooms can be a wonderful tool for really any age. I appreciate a lot of what the gentleman from Stanford has said. I do think that one of the issues with high school is that it's very limiting to what students can learn. And granted, you know, we give them what we think is the best knowledge and the best way to equip them for life. But in that age group and in childhood, are the years that we're supposed to expand our knowledge and expand our experiences and find what our passions are. And I think that if schools would use the virtual classrooms in conjunction with typical classrooms so that students can get those important interactions and face-to-face interactions and team-building kind of tools, but also to be able to take atypical classes that would not really ever be offered in a regular classroom environment so that they can possibly be you know, or have a better idea of what they want to do with the rest of their lives once they
right go right beyond their school if they need to. You see opportunity here, Cellini. I think you're going to be a great educator. Bill Tucker, we've just got a minute left here. How important an element of the national education future do you see in online instruction? Is this going to come to be a major supplement or even alternative to brick-and-mortar schools around this country?
So increasingly, I think we're going to see that we don't think of public education as a building. We think of much more fluidity in education, just like the parent in Fernandina Beach who talked about his daughter taking classes online, taking extracurriculars in the traditional school and also community colleges. And those types of opportunities are the ones we're going to want to offer. We've got to make sure that they're high quality. That's the bottom line.
Pitfalls here, but also tremendous opportunity. You can look at the downside, but the upside can be great if, as you say, the quality is maintained, if we keep it high, but really a space to watch and growing very rapidly. Bill Tucker with Education Sector in Washington, I want to thank you for being with us today. It's been great. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Jeffrey Scarborough with Stanford Online High School. We really appreciate you sharing some of your insights with us today, Jeffrey. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
And Clifford Nass at Stanford University as well, the Communication Between Humans and Interactive Media Lab. Clifford, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Listeners, thank you for being here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.